You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Markaz al-Sahaba.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Juma Mubarak. The beautiful day of Juma has arrived again. Equal to two Eids. And we get it every single week. Alhamdulillah. This most gracious day is upon us once again. Inshallah, you've done your Quran readings. You've made your 100 durood after Maghrib Salah. 70 needs in the dunya, 30 needs in the akhirah will be met just with that. This is a wonderful day. Allah Ta'ala increases rewards in this day for good deeds. This is a night for durood. This is a night for ibadah. This is a day for durood. Durood throughout the day. Of course, this is also a day when du'as are most assuredly accepted. We are told that time for acceptance can be from the moment the imam sits down on the minbar until the finalization of salah, I was told. Many people say that it is, you know, just while he's sitting down, but apparently that time continues until the end of salah. And also, after Asr Salah today, you can just 80. You just read 80. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad nabiyyi wa ali wa sallim taslima. Just read that 80 times, and Allah Ta'ala will bless you the sawab equivalent to 80 years of ibadah. That as told by Abu Huraira radhiyallahu anhu. So that's a highly esteemed source, and it is a wonderful business opportunity. You know, you want to make a minimal investment to get a maximum return. This is ROI like you'll never get anywhere in the world. Yeah, alhamdulillah, Allah Ta'ala has provided us with this most wonderful of days. Well, it's been a pretty busy day on international markets. Wrestling between the United States and mainland China. Donald Trump saying yes, he's hoping for a one-on-one with Xi Jinping of China, the leader of China. And whether or not, a personal meeting with Donald Trump holds as much allure as it did apparently to Imran Khan of Pakistan, whether or not Xi Jinping will be thinking to himself, wow, I'm going to be able to sit with Donald Trump, we have my photograph taken with him. I don't think it's got that big an attraction. It would seem that the Chinese do not like diplomacy being managed through tweets, through rough rudeness and brusqueness. This is a time, you know, you can remind yourself when you look at Donald Trump that, one of the doors of Jannah is good manners, good adab. It's a far cry from the 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt used to say that when you want to project international power, of course Teddy Roosevelt was a president that oversaw the emergence of America as a true imperialist power with the war against Spain, took over Manila, started moving, taking over, basically taking colonies. It was a period of expansion that was accelerated with the outbreak of World War I. Britain, in order to pay for her war debts, had to transfer a whole lot of colonies and assets across to the United States. And the same thing happened with World War II. At the end of World War II, America was fully, without any doubt, a fully colonial power. The Monroe Doctrine relating to America's rights to dictate the political direction of the Americas, North and South, also something led America into the world of imperialism. With the Suez Canal crisis, Britain's Foreign Office files, the famous files that administered the colonies for so many years, were transferred lock, stock and barrel across to the lock, stock and filing cabinet across to Washington. And I suppose you could say the brain of colonialism after that was transferred to the United States. The United States is no longer projecting power like it used to do in Teddy Roosevelt's days. Teddy Roosevelt used to say that the secret to maintaining a good, strong international image is to walk softly but carry a big stick. Nowadays, America is waving big sticks around and it's shouting very loudly. And, the shrill crescendo, which are the levels to which it has reached, indicative that this isn't a world superpower that is confident of its position or its abilities, or indeed of its partners and opponents. Increasingly, America entering into deals with people and then pulling out of them. You never know if you enter into a deal with the United States whether or not it's going to be worth the paper it's written on. China, I'm sure, must be looking at the United States as seeing this irascible president making outrageous demands in the rudest of ways. This is so anti-Chinese, it's unbelievable. Anyone who's got a remote... kind of like understanding of Chinese culture, and I'm not saying I'm one of those people, but I do know that face is a very important thing to the Chinese. Good manners are illustrated by ensuring that a person doesn't lose face in public, very much in accordance with the lines of adab as espoused by Nabi Kareem sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You must be sensitive to the other person's position. And that's in essence, I suppose, what lies behind the Chinese version of face. Donald Trump is rude. He insults. He treats people as inferiors. And that is something that China, after having endured America, French and British warships sailing up the Yangtze to bombard the Forbidden Palace, which was the home of the emperor at the time, there's no way they're going to forget that, you know. And so when America speaks about being a democracy and believing in human rights, and then, you know, basically speaks to them as though they're second-class citizens, it just doesn't go down well with China. And I'm quite sure that China is saying, well, if we do get a trade deal with the United States, what's going to stop the United States from doing exactly the same thing as they've done with the nuclear deal, the joint parties agreement that took so long to hammer together? And then 2 years later, America just says, we're pulling out of it. It's a lousy deal. If China were to enter into a trade deal with America today, what would stop America, Donald Trump at the helm, from turning around next month, next week, next year, and saying, okay, this trade deal, we're tearing it up again? Are they saying, why should we bother with this? Yeah, it's causing problems all around the world. A bit of a claw back today with the Donald Trump like offering, I suppose you could only say, a Donald Trump-style olive branch to the Chinese, saying, yeah, I know, we can have a one-on-one meeting and so on, but China must be saying, you know, we don't need tinsel and sparklers here. We're not interested in that kind of thing. Maybe Donald Trump seems to think it will count something, but I don't think China's putting much weight to it. They must be looking at the fact, like, whether one of the main oil suppliers is Iran, and they're going to continue. They're not going to back down out of that, out of keeping Iran as a main oil supplier, and America threatening sanctions and saying there's not going to be any exceptions. China must be saying to themselves, look, what's going to happen? We see we're going to sign a trade deal with them this month or next month, or maybe we sign a trade deal with them next year. They're going to slap sanctions on us for, dealing with Iran. So, China is forced now in a position where it is backs against the wall. And it's this kind of like brinkmanship, which is characteristic of that other blonde-haired idiot on the other side of the Atlantic, Boris Johnson, regarding his negotiations with Brexit. Yeah, we're going to go and we're going to give it to the Europeans. Yeah, we're not going to pay our £49 billion that we said we would pay as part of the Brexit breakup. We're going to withhold that money. Well, you can say that right now before you even head into the negotiating table. Your negotiating position is clearly put out there, and of course it's brinkmanship once again, and that leaves the EU with no room to kind of like maneuver on their side, and that means that before negotiations even start, any talks even happen, that is going to be a refusal. Well, now Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom says he's getting all the other parties together to try and, I don't know, try and force an election if there is a hard Brexit. You know, many people pointing out that around about 90,000 people elected Boris Johnson into his position. Of course, it's very much a repeat of Gordon Brown quite a few years ago when he took over from Tony Blair. Tony Blair was hoping to go for a third term, and the Labour Party revolted. And as a result of that, Gordon Brown took over the helm as British Prime Minister, and he wasn't elected either. So now we have Boris Johnson moving in, and he's also an unelected British Prime Minister. Parliamentary rules in Britain do not require an election in order to change Prime Ministers. So we have a situation where Jeremy Corbyn is saying he's quite sure that the people of Britain are not, you know, at least you can say with Gordon Brown, he didn't take any sort of crazy adventurous positions as Boris Johnson has done. And many people before Boris Johnson took over in Britain were saying that they wanted either an election or another referendum on the Brexit. And Boris Johnson said, no, we've already had our referendum, and we've already had the people speak, and so I'm going to implement a democracy. You know, one of the most undemocratically nominated leaders of the British Parliament, one of the least liberal, one of the most irascible, one of the most racist, is now saying that he's standing up for democracy. Well, that's not going down well with the public. Of course, it's not going down well in Ireland either. They don't want to have a hard border introduced between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland after having becoming so used to the idea of just being able to cross over. You know, it's almost, you know, that's like crossing over from Gauteng into the Free State. And now there's going to be a return to a hard border. There's going to be a return to tensions. There's going to be a return to conflict. And if that's going to happen, then it's going to be a return to the Troubles. So Ireland are now suggesting that perhaps what Sinn Féin should do is, Sinn Féin is the armed wing of the Irish Republican Army, or rather the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. They have 7 seats in Ulster, and the suggestion is that now Sinn Féin resign those seats. But, you know, the odd thing about the Sinn Féin seats in the British Parliament is that Sinn Féin never actually appointed anyone to take up the seats. They won the seats in the election, but then they didn't appoint anyone to go sit in the parliament, which was a bit of a loss, a bit of a setback, because the real Irish voice regarding the hard border in Ireland was never heard throughout all of this whole thing, simply because Sinn Féin said that on a principal position, there is no ways that they're going to put someone into the British Parliament in order to oversee their own oppression. Something which you could say is what is happening in Gaza at the moment. I haven't seen any like sort of big news reports about it, but Hamas have entered into a deal with Nazi Israel, and that is that they have now got their own perimeter patrols now going and ensuring that no one in Gaza is going to attack Israel. So basically they're in the sort of situation that Fatah has been in since 2006 when they won the, Hamas won that election. Fatah has been in ever since the PLO was the preferred negotiating partner to the Oslo peace accord process. That's right. That's how Fatah has got its international presence and continued presence in the West Bank. So now Fatah was put into that unacceptable position of now policing the West Bank on behalf of apartheid Israel. And it's a difficult situation. It's a difficult situation. Well, Sinn Féin said, well, we're not going to police our own oppression. And it's something that Fatah has found itself pulled into. And I seriously suspect it's got something to do with the Leviathan oil field off the coast of Gaza. There's Gaza is entitled to, I think, about 25% of the proceeds. And the Israelis have said that there's no ways that we're going to pay for all of this. So it seems as though there's been some kind of like backdoor kind of agreement regarding flow of funds. And Hamas, you know, I say very often that we need to replace the corporation with the clan. And when I speak about the corporation, I don't just mean like Anglo-American and De Beers. I also mean political parties like the ANC, Labour Party, the Republican Party in America, and so on, the Socialists in France, and so on. They are all corporations too, artificial personalities created in law, given a right to legal representation in the courts and so on, given legal rights of personality and so on. But of course, they're artificial personalities. And one of the fundamentals of Islamic business is that you have to do business with a person. So, of course, these aren't real persons, and so this is where the difficulty lies. And, of course, it is the means of the 1% to maintain the veil, to hide their corruption. This is the veil of the West, I've said many times on the show. And, well, Fatah is as much a corporation as the ANC or Anglo-American, for that matter. Of course it is, you know, allows people to make deals behind closed doors. And the and this now deal where Fatah finds itself, I mean, Hamas finds itself in a position where it is now policing the border. It is now policing what they're calling the fence. Can you believe it? They're calling that huge, big wall, bigger than the Berlin Wall, they're calling the fence. Hamas is calling it the fence. It's, you know, it's these means, you know, dicing and chopping up the Islamic world after World War One, putting us all behind these artificial borders, giving us countries. You know, you're sitting on an oil field and suddenly your oil field is a country and you've got like 40,000 people that are going to be enjoying financial largesse far in excess of anything anyone else is going to enjoy in the world, and you've basically got to do very little. You know, it's such a sweet deal, it's difficult to turn down. And hence, here now we find the Muslim world, and no matter how we try and unite, we try to unite as foreigners to each other. It's a very strange circumstance. Cause of many problems. But anyway, yes, many problems in the world. Nevertheless, today was a better day than usual for the South African rand. We've risen 1% against the dollar, 0.6% against the pound, and 1.35% against the euro. That's largely thanks to kind of like Donald Trump kind of like offering that olive branch, but whether or not that's going to result in anything significant going forward in terms of the trade talks remains to be seen. I like seriously have my own personal doubts in that regard. The JSE All Share on 53,840, continuing that downward trend. We were told foreigners are putting money out of the markets. A flight is safer, you could say. It's been a trend we've seen repeated ever since the Asian flu of 1997. Money flowing into the United States, people were putting their money into U.S. treasuries, and that's seen as the safest place. And then when risk returns into the market and it starts looking far more appealing, that's when they come into the emerging markets. So in many ways, this is a consequence of international dynamics. But of course, here at home, we're hardly playing the sort of game that would provide some kind of like local support for all of these kind of like indicators that we have regarding economic health in South Africa. Gold is currently trading at $1,520 a fine ounce. Big winners on the JSE today were Discovery, Standard Bank, Rand Merchant Bank, Absa Bank, and Nedcor. Sure, bankers all across the way. I suppose that's with the Rand, with the Rand increasing. The Goldfields, Africa Rainbow Minerals, Assore, Cap, is also a regular feature lately, and Anglo Plat. So that's four out of those five big losers on the JSE today are also in the resources sector. Well, I guess that says something. Today, good news coming out from Impala Platinum, saying that they're expecting a profit at their next results. So, yeah, if you're feeling it's time to enter the market, you've got a little bit of loose money lying around, maybe you go and buy some Implat shares and share in the dividend. Because people are saying now it's time for Implats to pay the dividend. They've just made a nice bond deal. They've reduced their corporate bond costs. Higher platinum prices, they've settled a whole lot of debt, they've got their operations up and running efficiently, and that means that all things being equal, Anglo Platinum should be issuing a dividend. I don't think Anglo Platinum has said anything in that regard, but there seem to be market expectations that there's a dividend in the offing. China has called planned U.S. tariffs on an additional $300 billion of Chinese goods a violation of accords reached by President Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, signaling its intention to impose retaliatory measures. This is the reason why the JSE continues to do so badly. Short Thursday statement from the Chinese State Council Tariff Committee did not say what measures would be imposed, and we are still waiting to hear. Former Deputy Finance Minister BC Jonas, who said that at one stage he's offered 600 million rands, and he was told he can take over as finance minister during Jacob Zuma's presidency. He says that South Africa isn't far removed from chaos, and that there exists a historic opportunity for government to effect drastic and necessary structural changes to the economy and the country. Well, I must say that is really that's major spin. And, you know, there may be some truth in it. You'll find very often in times of crisis, money that has been held or hoarded is forced into release. Historians looking back at the Islamic conquests and the massive wealth that flowed back to Makkah and Medina in the wake of those conquests say, well, have a look at where did that money come from? You know, a lot of that money was in terms of gold and jewelry and vases and so on. A whole lot of money that people had been keeping hoarding in safety and not spending. You know, lazy money, as, you know, there was a term 20 years ago in South Africa, you know, lazy money. You don't want money to be sitting around doing nothing, just collecting interest. You want it operating and working in the economy. And I would say that is very much a problem that we're facing today. We do have a lot of money. There are big war chests among the JSE companies, and they're not investing it locally. In many ways, this is providing ammunition for the people who say that we need to have, and once again, I can't remember the word, we need to have... When you force people to invest in certain things, prescribed assets, yes, that's what they called it, prescribed assets, you know, you force pension funds, investment companies and so on, and perhaps even JSE companies, they've got huge big war chests and they're not really doing anything, but just earning interest on it. You force them to invest a portion of their funds in certain state assets, such as like buying Eskom bonds and so on, and this is the thing that has got South Africans worried. Well, you know, pension fund managers and so on worried that, you know, they're going to force us to put money into Eskom, and that's just like throwing money into an empty hole, into a bottomless pit. So it is causing problems, but, you know, when it comes to other things, I mean, the prescribed assets in South Africa during apartheid were enforced on the country because of the international credit lines being cut and the embargo against apartheid. As a result of that, the apartheid government then forced pension funds and so on to invest a certain amount of their money in state assets and so on. And it is a result of that that we actually have like four trillion rands worth of investment money here in South Africa, 4 trillion rands of investment of pension fund money here in South Africa. So, you know, if that money is not being invested, locally, Well, then, you've also got Regulation 28, which also restricts the amount of money that pension funds are allowed to invest overseas, and they have been complaining about that. But that 4 trillion rand that we have was largely a result of the apartheid government saying, you've got to invest this money locally, you've got to invest it in our projects. But, of course, the projects were better administered in those days. Nowadays, that is not the situation. We do not have, you know, at least when the apartheid government built the power station, it would actually start producing power. And I'm afraid that is not something that we can say about Medupi or Kasile. That's run about 350 billion rands worth of money being thrown at them. There's even talk that we just walk away from these investments, and that just doesn't sit well with me. It's like one of those sickening things that you have. BC Jonas says that it's not all dark here. This could be a moment of opportunity for us. You know, in many ways, you could say that the ability of the ANC to negotiate at what did they call those negotiations? I can't believe I've actually forgotten about them. What's the name of those? During negotiations to end apartheid, the ANC had a certain kind of political power, and they don't have that kind of they didn't have the same kind of power that they have now, and the forces opposing them were far stronger. Now, the ANC is in power, and the economy is trotting around like a drunk man or someone who's been starved to death. And, it is a moment for stout hearts, for clear minds, and for sincerity. Whether or not we're going to be able to get sincerity is a major issue. Because if you look at the amount of money, you know, I was speaking yesterday saying that it was actually Trevor Manuel who put together the mechanism that allowed us to actually go and pay for all of this infrastructure that we've seen installed at Medupi and Kasile, and the 1056 locomotive deal where we bought all these locomotives from Belgium and they couldn't fit onto our railway lines. We entered into we had to pay Airbus $4 billion or 4 billion rand when we pulled out of a deal we're going to buy Airbuses and so on. There's all kinds of terrible things that have been done ever since Jacob Zuma came onto the scene. And whether or not we're going to be able to turn it around or not remains to be seen. Now, I know a whole lot of people may dislike Ace Magashule, the state capture guys. But, these two formations that have grown up within the ANC, looters. A looter's continuer. I would say Ace Magashule is a looter continuer. Yes, he is. I would say he is. You know, put a gun against my head, is Ace Magashule to be trusted? Not a chance. Not a chance. But you see, they represent a populist portion of the ANC, a populist portion of this country that are not having their rights and expectations met, legitimate expectations met. And so they're falling increasingly behind the demagogues. And if the other portion of the ANC is only able to kind of like follow the mainstream economic line, then these two camps within the ANC are inevitably going to draw further and further apart. And it is up to people like Ace Magashule, or it is up to people like Cyril Ramaphosa, to start giving a clear and concise voice to the people that Ace Magashule has hijacked and has got behind him in support. You need to start giving voice to those people's needs more clearly. Ace Magashule isn't going to do it. Julius Malema isn't going to do it. It's up to the Amaklevas within the ANC to start doing that. They need to come down off the high horses. You know, they go to university, they get degrees, and they come out and, you know, they get into the positions because they're able to speak the language of the formal economy. And they hold on to those positions by continuing to speak the language of the formal economy, much like Lesetha Kanyago is doing that as head of the Reserve Bank. He says the barbarians are at the gate. He's definitely speaking the language of the formal economy. But he's most definitely not addressing what is in actual fact a groundswell of bitter resentment to the fact that the formal economy is not doing anything for them. You take the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people who are living there in the rural areas outside Nelspruit, in Hazy View, in Giani, and so on. And you speak about trickle-down effect. You know, people voted in 1994 and they're dead. Their children are now still waiting. They're not going to listen to trickle-down nonsense. Something needs to be done. The Amaklevas within the ANC need to start giving a clear and articulate voice to that groundswell. And if they don't, the country is never, ever, ever going to come right. But anyway, that's my overview for today. Let's go into more detail when we return from this quick commercial break, inshallah.
You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Assalamu alaikum, welcome back. Well, just now, if you want to share your views on the show, you can WhatsApp us on 084-786-3132, or you can give us a call here in Lanesia on 010-001-004, 010-001-004. WhatsApp us on 084-786-3132. So, we were saying before the break that BC Jonas believes that South Africa is in far removed from chaos, but nevertheless, this is introducing a fluidity into the situation, and there is coming into being a historic opportunity where we can have a major sea change. We can turn things around. You know, moments of crisis can do that, but of course moments of crisis can do exactly the opposite, and generally when the moments of crisis arrive, they generally tend to go south rather than north. But nevertheless, BC Jonas is saying that yeah, we can in actual fact turn this around. We can turn this into an opportunity. If we are going to turn this into an opportunity, then you know, it's going to be up to very much the people who were at his book launch yesterday. He's just published a book entitled After Dawn, Hope After State Capture. And it's the very people who are attending his book launch who are actually facing the major challenge. I don't think Ace Magashule and Julius Malema actually have the wherewithal, the intellectual wherewithal, to in actual fact find a meeting place between formal economic needs and the informal groundswell of resentment that they represent. Theirs is very much, you know, they're able to get away with what they do. They're able to command this kind of potential palace revolutionary body within the ANC. They're able to contain this because there is very strong resentment and widespread resentment in South Africa. And we've seen it here in Soweto just last night in the xenophobia that has been breaking out once again. The Sowetans going and burning and looting foreigners' shops. Saying, yeah, no, we're doing it because they were attacking the police in Joburg CBD last week. Whereas in actual fact, it's got very little to do with that. And it's got to do with the inability of the economy to grow. It's got to do with the dwindling economy. And people are feeling it everywhere. You know, you catch a minibus nowadays and it's very much a regular thing that someone in the minibus is missing 1 rand. I dropped 1 rand. The person doesn't own up. You know, it comes to the final tally to the person on the front seat, and suddenly, there's 1 rand. 1 rand missing. Who's missing the 1 rand? Where's the 1 rand? Where's the 1 rand? And there's no one turning up. And you know that the taxi driver gets angry, and You know, that kind of thing used to be... I only encountered it in actual fact. This is only the second time I'm encountering it. And that is, it was after the 2008 crisis. That started becoming a common phenomenon. So it's quite interesting. I wonder if the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry has ever considered of, like, implementing a consumer indicator measurer in minibus taxi drivers, cabs, to see how many times somebody doesn't have enough money to pay for this one rand missing out of the total. Yeah, because really, when South Africa starts going into economically troubled times, people in minibus taxis suddenly don't have enough money, but nevertheless they have to get into the taxi, and they do, and the desperation is such that they're going to try and cheat their way into work or into seeking work or into somewhere else where they can trade and make some money. Yeah, well, we are. But nevertheless, the kind of people who were at BC Jonas's book launch yesterday are, in actual fact, the kind of people who are facing the challenge to enunciate and to meet the needs of this groundswell. Because this groundswell is a groundswell of anger. It is a groundswell of emotion. It is a groundswell reacting to the conditions that people are living in. And it needs to be given a voice. It needs to be given a direction. Otherwise, you know, this historic opportunity that BC Jonas is speaking about is going to pass us by, and we're going to descend into chaos. So that means it's up to Pravin Gordhan, Lungisa Fuzile, Ismail Momoniat, Yolisa Tianchi, people like that, Cyril Ramaphosa. Huh? The Amaklevas of the ANC really now have to start producing. They really have to start producing. So far, the ANC has not been able to transform in any way the system that it's taken over. And instead, the system is transforming the ANC. And the ANC, the Amaklevas, are being pushed out and no longer able to represent that populist part of the ANC. And whether or not Ace Magashule and them are able to represent that either is an arguable point. But nevertheless, they are able to attract their support. You know, so if we want to devolve into populism and anarchy, well then, you know, it's only going to happen because the Amaklevas are unable to, in actual fact, rise to the challenge that is facing us right now in this country. Also in attendance, Lesetse Kanyago, the Reserve Bank Governor, former IDC Minister Derek Hanekom, Bulelani Nguga, former Minister of Public Enterprises. He was married to the woman who was kidnapping Muslims out of South Africa while she was Minister of Police. Barbara Hogan. Mark Barnes was there. He's a really nice guy, I must say. Mark Barnes. He's the kind of like white South African we need in this country. I mean, I first met Mark Barnes quite a few years ago. I had to go and interview him after he'd beaten up one of the board members of the JSC. I thought to myself, yes, here you go, here's someone, here's a man of character, he's a character, yeah, he is mos, you know, they get those characters, né? Yeah, he's very much a character, and he's a man who wants to make things work. I would say he's a man whose heart is in the right place. May Allah Ta'ala bless him with his diet. Also, Johan Kuchler, there's another guy. Yeah, there's another white South African I like. I once sat in a court case he was presiding in. It was before he became famous as the head of the the Independent Electoral Commission. He was the first head of the first Independent Electoral Commission that oversaw the 1994 elections. Proved himself to very much to be a no-nonsense kind of guy, a guy who could sort things out. Maybe we should make him chief executive of Eskom. That wouldn't be a bad choice, you know. Or maybe, you know, Old Mutual Chief Executive, Peter Moyo. You know, come on, Peter. You've shown yourself to be a guy who can, like, stand up and fight a good fight. Imagine if John Barnes, Peter Moyo, and Jan Kirchler went and took over the top post in Eskom. I think we might have something there with Vuyan Ngwana as the legal officer. Man, you know, that would be an A-team of note. That would be like Power Rangers on steroids. You know, we do have talented people in this country. That court case, I was sitting with Johan Kwichler, it was a case about a motorist who had lost his arm. He was coming around the wilds in Johannesburg there, to the north of the Joburg CBD. It's a twisty road. It's a night time. He was going downhill. And Joburg water workers had been working on a pipe there and had not closed a fire hydrant. The fire hydrant was spewing water, a stream, a river, across the Wilds Road. It's now Joe Slova Road. In those days, it used to be. It doesn't matter. He went round the bend and hit this water. His bike just went out from under him and he crashed into another car and he lost his arm. So now he was suing Joburg Water for loss of income and, you know, pain and suffering and medical costs and so on. You know, we sat in this court case with a lot of evidence going about, you know, like the medical costs and the difficulties of living without an arm and, you know, prosthetic devices and so on and costs of prosthetic devices and having to go undergo surgery and having to undergo physiotherapy and so on, and you know, all these things about this guy. He's lost his right arm, and you know, it's his main arm, and he's right-handed, and he can't even hug his child anymore, and the emotional costs of that, and not being able to use your right arm to hug your child and so on, you know, the usual kind of thing, I suppose you could say. And eventually it came time for the actual motorist now. You know, all the experts and the family members and so on have been given evidence, and now it's his turn to take the dock. And we turned from lunch in the afternoon, and Johan Kirchler, he kind of like walks in and he sits down, and he's told by the court orderly. He's told by the court orderly that his clerk isn't there, and usually the clerk is the person who takes the oath. So Jan Kirchler is obviously very deeply in thought about something, chewing over after lunch, and he sits down and he says, right, okay, I'll then administer the oath. And so he says without looking up, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Raise your right hand and say, so help me God. So this motorist, the motorbike guy, I see he's standing in the dock, and he goes, looks at the judge and he says, I don't have a right arm. Not often you'll see Jan Kirchner making a mistake. But yeah, anyway, that was a fair moment. So Jonas told the audience last night at his book launch that the ANC's fight back against state capture was mostly driven out of self-interest. Most of the push against state capture is about saving the ANC. And I think that saving the party is still up for debate. Whether or not it has actually happened is another matter. There was a complete demobilization with the New Dawn, and those that resisted state capture only recently reorganized themselves again because the factions that are resisting reforms have resources. And I think we underestimate the depth of the fight back. He appreciates the extent to which institutions like the National Prosecuting Authority have been damaged by state capture, he says, but action against those that have enabled grand corruption must be taken urgently. Unless, he says, unless we see ministers or former ministers prosecuted, the fight against state capture will remain theoretical. But the NPA should rather ensure success in prosecutions than having to withdraw a case that isn't ready. I understand that. Right, okay. So people have been saying, you know, with all the state capture inquiries and so on, why haven't the police started arresting people? You know, everyone is hearing all these allegations being put But, you know, before you go and arrest someone, you have to make sure that all of your ducks are in a row. Vian Gowane has said that there are steps that people should be taking and could be taking, and they're not taking. So, of course, people are, bureaucrats are worrying about their jobs. So what about if I go after these guys and then Ace Magashule takes over as president of South Africa? Is that also an issue? You know, when I worked for the Road Accident Fund a few years ago doing the public relations, one of the major problems that we had, you know, because we were taking on the lawyers led by that dog of a lawyer, Ronald Bobroff, who's now, you know, he's a former South African Law Society president. He's now a fugitive from justice in Australia. Can you believe it? Yeah. Mm. He once called me my boy. That was a very big mistake, Ronald. Anyway, he had a very nice silken tie. He loved silken ties, old Donald. Ronald. Yeah, they're both the same kind of guy, aren't they? Yeah, they are, in actual fact. Ronald Bobroff and Donald Trump. Very much the same kind of guy. And that is not a flattery. Yeah. We were fighting against the lawyers who were taking too much money. The Contingency Fees Act restricted their cut to 25%, and they said that this is unconstitutional. Why should we listen to it? Because lawyers in the United States allowed to charge anything they like. We believe the same system should be here in South Africa. We believe that we should turn the entire South African advocates and attorneys field into a bunch of vultures chasing ambulances. And that is, in essence, what has happened to the South African legal fraternity. Huh? Come on, if you're a lawyer yourself and you're listening to this show, have you ever, like, sort of taken up a criminal case for someone and you just haven't had time to prepare? You've gone and you've appeared before a magistrate time after time after time. There's about 10 postponements you have before the actual case eventually gets underway, and you charge 2,000 rand a pop. Huh? You take 20,000 rand from someone who can't really afford it, who's battling to pay their water and lights. You take 20,000 rand away from them before you even start looking at this case. And because you don't have enough time, you enter a plea bargain agreement with the prosecuting authority. And the guy might be as innocent as anything, and he's got to go to jail simply because you don't have enough time to give him proper legal representation that he's paid through the nose for. Yeah, how common is that here in South Africa? And, of course, you know, the Road Accident Fund and the lawyers are fighting that. We're clogging up the courts. By private prosecution, more than 50%, I think, still on the court roll are Road Accident Fund cases. This is the reason why, like, you know, we were turned into a no-challenge settlement, you know. You don't go and take the other driver to court and you end into old acrimonious kind of thing. Lawyers make a whole lot of money, but the Road Accident Fund eventually has to pay for both sides. And, you know, it's just too expensive. And, of course, then the lawyers come along and start taking more than 25% as the legislature had decided that would be the limit, as they're entitled to do. So the lawyers went on this mad kind of like disobedience campaign against the very law that made them lawyers. Very strange circumstance. And anyway, now Ronald Bobroff is in Australia. That'll teach you, Bob. You know, it pushes costs and money up all over the place. Just by the way, while we're on the Road Accident Fund, you know, many people say, yeah, I like the bloody Road Accident Fund. It's like, you know, it's always bankrupt. The amount of money, you know, we pay a certain amount of a fuel levy, and it goes to the Road Accident Fund, you know. But that money doesn't go directly to the Road Accident Fund. Instead, it goes to a general pool at Treasury, and then Treasury decides that to give a portion of the funds to the Road Accident Fund. So the Road Accident Fund doesn't actually get all of the money that we pay for the Road Accident Fund. That's one thing. And another thing, you know, you've got insurance, you've got car insurance, you've got medical aid insurance. You go and have a look at the small print in your medical aid and your short-term insurance, and you will go and see that you are required in the case of litigation to hand over your rights to your insurer so that they can go and collect that money from the Road Accident Fund. So the Road Accident Fund plays a vital role in terms of subsidizing the insurance sector here in South Africa. In fact, you could say that car insurance and road and traffic insurance would be completely completely unaffordable in South Africa if it wasn't for the road accident fund. So, you know, while people go and they hammer the road accident fund and they complain about it, the thing is that in South Africa, the insurance industry would not be viable if it wasn't for the road accident fund. And probably the same goes for the workmen's compensation and unemployment insurance, UIF. You know, all of these things are in actual fact state subsidies to the banking industry. Yeah, very interesting little, back door, back passage kind of things that get hidden behind the corporate veil. Good news, at least the International Monetary Fund says that South Africa isn't right now in need of an IMF bailout. There's been talk that we are rapidly approaching a situation where we're going to have to apply for an IMF bailout. You know, R4 trillion with the pension fund money in South Africa, we're going to have to apply for an IMF bailout, while at the same time Naspers has taken R1 trillion out of the country to go and create a European IT champion. Do you see that there's like a mismatch in all of this? You know, have a look at Julius Malema. Again, another day has passed, and Julius Malema has said nothing about the Bruder Bond, the Afrikaner Bond, taking R1 trillion out of South Africa. So, you know, you can't even get good populists in this country anymore. You can't even get good communists in this country anymore. The businessmen are lousy. The politicians are lousy. Well, you know, at least we got beautiful weather. We got beautiful people. We got friendly people. And, I think in many ways, South Africa still, despite all of these self-imposed shot in the foot because we didn't aim high enough, kind of wounds, self-inflicted wounds we're giving to ourselves. Nevertheless, we are still a blessed nation. I really do believe that South Africa is a blessed nation. And, Allah Ta'ala is control of everything. Don't become too despondent because of the frailties of humankind. Don't become despondent because things are looking so dark. Remember, dua can change takdir. Dua can change takdir. Oh Allah, bless this country. Oh Allah, free us of corruption. Oh Allah, bless us. Bless us with good and honest, reliable, strong and forthright leaders. With iman. Oh Allah, surround those leaders with the best of helpers. As you did with Nabi Kareem, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Oh Allah, and surround them all with the best of followers. Make us like the Sahaba. Make us like the Sahaba, O Allah, that we support our leaders. Yeah, there's a saying, you know, that people get the government they deserve. I don't know how true that is, given the frailties and limitations of this Western system that we have, whether or not we have true, full, legitimate leaders in government. But I don't think we're as bad as the United States and Britain and Europe. And for that, I think, Allah Ta'ala will. Oh, yeah, Allah. We're not deserving of it. Look at what idiots we are in this country. But please, Allah, bless us and favor us and lead us and protect us anyway. Because you are most kind. Ar-Rahman. Ar-Rahim. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. You are Al-Qahar. You are in control of everything. You are Al-Wahhab. You are the giver of everything. Oh, Allah, give this country the best. Ameen, ameen, ameen. Well, that's it. That's all we have time for today. Jazakumullah for joining us. I make dua that whatever trading activity you got up to today is profitable. And above all, halal. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.